Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and this is On Point. It's a new year, a symbolic chance at a fresh start. For many of us, that means resolving to change something in our lives. But some people are already making change. Innovators who are altering systems in healthcare, drug discovery, food production, renewable energies. People who are trying to change the world in areas that desperately need it. This hour on Point, innovators shaking up the status quo. You can join us on air or online. As you look out into 2018, where do you see a need for innovation or change? What's your big idea? What problems do you see, and what are your proposals for fixing them? Think big or small. We want to hear ideas of all kinds and sizes. We want to know what's working in your communities. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from London is Mark Stevenson. He's a futurist in residence at the National Theatre of Scotland, and he's the author of An Optimist's Tour of the Future. His new book is We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. And that's the book we're going to talk about today. Mark Stevenson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Mark, big, broad question first. For those of us who aren't as familiar with what it means to be a futurist, how do you define what you are and what you do?
Oh, that's a really great question. I get asked it all the time. I actually don't really like the term that much, but there's no qualifications for being a futurist as far as I can work out. My qualification was I wrote a book with the word future in the title, and then people started calling you it. I don't think there's any real definition. I can tell you what I do, which is I try and help the people I work with that's governments or corporations or schools or individuals, become what I call future literate, by which I mean understanding the questions the future is asking us and then trying to architect their lives, their businesses, their careers so that they can play their part in making that future and answering those questions in a way that makes the future more sustainable, equitable, humane or just. So it's kind of systems thinking. It's getting out there, looking at the cutting edge of innovation, but it's also realizing that technology isn't always the answer. In fact, very often it's not at all, but it does ask us a lot of very interesting questions, and we need to be literate about those if we're going to have any chance of making the world we want.
When you decided to write your most recent book about innovators and innovation, is it more because you were fascinated by the innovations or you were dismayed by the problems that the innovations were meant to correct?
Well, a bit of both. I mean, all my books are questions, and after I finished my first book, which is really about sort of technology and the climate and just kind of trying to give people a basic primer on what's out there on the cutting edge, I finished that book realizing that, you know, we had all the technology and all the talent we needed to make the world fantastic for everybody. It wasn't a shortage of resources and it wasn't a shortage of innovative thinking or whatever. What seemed to be lacking was the way we organize ourselves, the systems that govern us and the systems that, you know, decide how our corporations work or our schools work and the interplay of those systems. So the motivation behind this book was to go and say, well, who's gone and done something about that? Who's gone and done some actual systems change that I can actually see that's worked? And to get into the book, you know, they had to be prevailing. They had to have succeeded. So there's lots of, you know, systems change innovations that happen and then they kind of get crushed.
So are you saying
that you
think in many cases the answers, the innovations actually exist out there? They're out there. We just haven't found a way to get them out there and make them large scale.
Yeah, I mean, William Gibson famously said the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed yet. What I realized was there's lots of futures that are already here and we have to decide which ones to distribute. So my motivation in this book was to go and find people who'd successfully done innovations in healthcare, food production, energy production, governance, education, and go, well, what did you do? How did you succeed? And does that give us a roadmap to and a window on a better future?
I was so interested that basically you seem to say that the biggest hurdle is not technology, it's the status quo, that it's a very powerful force to overcome the status quo. In fact, you have that great Ronald Reagan quote. Ronald Reagan said, status quo, you know, is Latin for the mess we're in. So give a sense of how hard is it to overcome the way we've always done it?
It's almost impossible, but luckily we managed to. There's a great quote from Peter Drucker, who's a business theorist at Harvard. And anybody in business will have heard this quote: culture eats strategy for breakfast. So you can know what you need to do, but if the culture of your organization, you know, is such that everybody's getting paid doing it the old way, then you're going to have a lot of trouble moving forward. Upton Sinclair, the great American novelist, wrote in one of his novels, it's very difficult to get somebody to understand something when their salary depends upon them not understanding it. So guess what? A big utility firm doesn't really want to hear about, community-owned, locally generated renewables because, it affects how they pay their wages.
Right. You write that for innovators, their enemies are anyone who's done well under the old conditions, because if you do well under the old conditions, why would you necessarily want to change it? The incentive is not to change it.
Yeah, and if you look at our world at the moment, we talk about mass inequality that's sort of sweeping across the world and getting ever worse. Well, because we have some people who are doing very well out of it, and they have all the power, and they're not likely to want to sort of share that power. And this is one of the reasons we have this kind of wholesale evaporation of trust in the institutions that govern society. Because, this isn't along party political lines; it's against those who are doing okay out of it, which are generally the people working for those systems and those governments. And the rest of us are going, hang on, my wages haven't gone up, my healthcare is getting worse, the jobs are stagnating or less well paid or have more restrictive contracts or whatever. So yeah, it's a huge, huge challenge.
Mark Stevenson, you mentioned this a few minutes ago, but I think it's worth repeating that in order for an innovation to be included in your new book, the innovators had to be succeeding right now in the real world. It couldn't be an idea for later. It had to be happening now.
Yeah.
The very first one you write about is healthcare. And this one's interesting because what the person set out to do didn't really work, but then he set out to do something different. Tell us about that one.
That's the wonderful story of Jamie Hayward. So Jamie, mechanical engineer by training, his brother gets what we call motor neuron disease and you call Lou Gehrig's disease. And so he quit his job in engineering and immediately decided to set up a not-for-profit biotech company to try and find a cure for motor neuron disease, which is, a pretty impressive ambition given that, nobody's really made any progress on that disease for since we discovered it, and he had no medical training. But, Jamie is that kind of guy. He actually failed to save his brother. But in the process, they collected a lot of data about his brother, and he realized that that data held a lot of potential to do wonderful things. The whole process of trying to save his brother also cost him his marriage. So he was sat on the internet, as many singles do, at an internet dating site, looking for a potential date. And he suddenly realized that people on dating sites share an awful lot of data very freely. They share their income level, their preferences, their height, where they live, or the things they enjoy, and that's all stored in a computable format such that the dating site can interrogate that and hopefully make successful matches. And he thought, why didn't my brother have the ability to connect with somebody, who had the same condition, the same progression of that condition, maybe the same weight, the same height? So kind of a dating site, if you want, for patients, because he'd collected so much data on his brother. He thought, if we were able to collect this data for lots of patients, we could probably help them do their self-care or, improve their outcomes, because actually patients know the most about their conditions because they're living with them day to day. And so he created that site. It was called Patients Like Me. And it is still called Patients Like Me, and it does exactly that. And the outcomes are quite extraordinary.
It started out specifically for ALS sufferers, but eventually expanded beyond that?
Yeah, it's just, I don't know how many conditions on it now. You'd have to go and look, but there's hundreds of conditions on there. And for people who are living with particularly chronic conditions that they're suffering with day to day, they're very happy to share quite a lot of their data, and they're finding they're able to collaborate and say, well, actually, I find if I take this drug after food, or actually this drug worked for me, didn't work for you. I mean, I tell the story of one patient who was cured of her debilitating epilepsy to the extent she was having sort of 12 or 13 seizures a day by the community she found on Patients Like Me. And there's lots of stories like that. And actually, when it comes to healthcare, most of the healthcare you get is self-care. You're the person who's looking after yourself most of the time, or the people around you. The interventions from the healthcare industry often, there's a minimal part of the time that's involved. So, there's a great quote in the book from an anthropologist called John Ferguson. He says, the patient is the most underutilized resource in the healthcare industry. And actually, if we can free them up to share their data, to collaborate with each other in conjunction with healthcare professionals, then you have these enormous upswings in outcomes and people's ability to survive or live with conditions that previously would have had a much worse outcome for them.
Mark Stevenson, we have a portion of an advertisement in which Jamie Haywood, who you write about in your book, talks about how Patients Like Me, the website he created, gives patients control. It gives them access to their healthcare information. It lets them compare that information to other patients' information, and how basically you can combine a social network with technology to help us improve and understand our health.
We now have the ability to understand what is the biology of health, what is the biology of aging, what is the biology of disease, and how can we build something that learns as a group a path to health? How can we take each of the variations that each of us experience throughout our lives and help form one common understanding of paths to health? And that's what Patients Like Me is building by adding biology and digital sensors to our already large 500,000 person network.
And Mark, I don't want us to forget that in terms of why you chose certain innovations, it's because they were to correct something that was broken. And in this case, the drug development system was broken. It takes something like 12 years on average to get a drug from development to market. Many pharmaceutical companies only want to focus on blockbuster drugs. And so you looked at this and thought, it's broken. And this was a way to basically crowdsource patient information to improve health in a way that Big Pharma isn't doing.
Yeah, that was the next thing I went to visit. So that wasn't Patients Like Me, although Patients Like Me are involved in that. That was a trip to go and see a man called Samir Brahmachari in Delhi, who'd come up with essentially a crowdsourced method of developing drugs by creating simulations of bacteria inside a computer and simulating drugs inside of them, which is a hugely complex thing to do. It's very hard for one organization to do it, but by a very clever crowdsourcing method that he developed along with a lady called Anshu and a chap called Rohit, they were able to basically create a computer simulation of tuberculosis, which is an incredible thing to do, because you know even the simplest bacteria is hugely complicated. So that was another great innovation, and they came up with new drugs for tuberculosis for $50 million as opposed to $2.6 billion, which the drugs industry quotes for.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This, with the recommendation for another podcast for you to check out, namely How I Built This. Every week, I talk to the people behind some of the most inspiring companies and brands in the world, with stories of incredible persistence, grit, and insight. You can find How I Built This on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're talking this hour about innovators who are updating our world in healthcare, drug discovery, food, renewable energy, and more. They're looking at systems they consider broken, and they're trying to make them better. Join this conversation. It's a new year, so let us know what systems in your community, in our country, in our world you think need an update. How can they be changed for the better? Tell us where you see problems and whether you have possible solutions. Maybe you've watched a problem in your community be solved locally, and maybe it has global applications. Tell us about it. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. The author of the book, We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World, is with us this hour. It's Mark Stevenson, who's joining us from London. And Mark, we have a full board of callers who want to weigh in. So let's go to some of those right away. One is Joel calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Joel, welcome to On Point, and tell us what you think in terms of what innovations are needed.
Hi, Sasha. Thank you for taking my call. I live here in the Charlotte area, and we're experiencing gentrification like many other large cities. And as a result, you know, square footage commercial real estate is very expensive. So the restaurant model, which has been typical throughout our community for decades now, simply isn't viable the way it was. And as a result, we have hundreds of food trucks in the area. I'm just wondering if, you know, he's talking technology and climate. I would think nothing speaks to that more than food itself. What does the future bring for us in terms of how we get our food locally? Are the grocery stores going to disappear like before World War II? Are we going to go back to having a butcher and a baker? Or is food delivery the future and we'll never go get food? I'm just curious what he has to say about that.
Joel, thanks for that. And Mark, before you weigh in, I want to go to one more caller who I think also has something to say related to food, so maybe you can comment on both of them. And this is Marcos calling from Hollywood, Florida. Marcos, welcome to On Point, and tell us your thoughts about innovation.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for taking my call. My comment was basically about the food industry and how there are some innovators that are making plant-based meat alternatives that's really making a positive impact on the community because animal products are basically the largest cause of climate change, and so it's a really huge issue that we all need to be addressing.
Marcos, thanks for that. Mark Stevenson, can you tell us what you found on the food front? Because one of your chapters does focus on that.
Yeah, in fact, there's a couple of chapters that concentrate on food. I mean, the first thing to say to Marcus's point is that the food system we have is staggeringly unsustainable. And I don't think people understand just how unsustainable it is. And the reason for that is because we've tried to replace nature with an industrial system. Now, there were lots of really good reasons for doing that in the first instance. We came up with this thing called the Green Revolution, and it was about industrializing farming so that we could feed the growing population. The problem is it came with a whole bunch of sustainability headaches. So the overuse of fertilizer, for instance, is causing $44 billion worth of damage to the American farming industry every year just through the soil that's eroding because the fertilizer decreases the ability of the soil to bind with itself. Our agriculture is so incredibly thirsty because the crops we use only respond and give us these high yields if we give them lots of water and fertilizer. So, you know, this is why you're seeing the water table dropping in California, for instance. And half the world's population now lives under water stress because of the agricultural demand for fresh water, which is a very small amount. So if we carry on the way we're going, then, you know, pretty much everything's going to collapse. And that's not good, clearly.
Factor in pesticides, herbicides, yeah, which you also write about.
We could go on for hours about the pesticide treadmill. So, you know, what happens is you create a monocrop and, you know, you try to say, well, we'll have the economies of scale because we're only going to grow this crop and we'll put all effort into that. But of course, the bug that really likes that crop goes, wow, there's a whole field of that stuff. I'm going there. So you have a pesticide to control the bug. But guess what? The bugs that survive that, they're really hardy and then, you know, they'll come and destroy your crop. So you need a more powerful pesticide. And you get on this thing called the pesticide treadmill. And same with herbicides as well. So this isn't necessarily a criticism of sort of, you know, industrial or approaches to farming per se, but on the whole, what we've ended up with is this kind of really kind of bizarre way of growing things. Because if we look around us, nature is very, very abundant. It knows how to grow stuff, and it doesn't do it, you know, in monocrops. It doesn't do it, you know, with huge amounts of machinery. It doesn't do it with huge amounts of fertilizer. It kind of works in this kind of symbiotic system. And so one of the things I looked at in the book was, you know, how can we tweak that sort of thing that nature does and help farmers to do that? And there's many reports into this now, and I went to see this in operation in India, in rural India, called agroecology. And it's essentially understanding the science of how nature is so bountiful and then just tweaking it a little bit with a few changes here and there, sometimes a little bit of fertilizer, sometimes a little bit of pesticides. And it turns out that you can get pretty much the yields we get from industrial farming by using these techniques, of which, you know, I cover a particular one to do with rice farming in the book. And what's really important about that is that those technologies, in inverted commas, you know, which might amount to sort of, you know, placing the seed slightly differently, weeding slightly differently, having a slightly different watering regime, etc., those techniques are open to and affordable by small farmers. And that's great because currently 56% of the world's food is still produced by small farmers. It's 500 million small family farms. At the moment, we're told they're part of the problem, that we need to replace them with industrial farming. Actually, it turns out they're part of the solution. And the good thing about that, of course, is it raises those families out of poverty if they can increase their yields two or three times, and now their kids can go to school. So it's just a win-win-win for everybody. It's a win for the farmers,
farming,
it's a win for the environment.
Farming in a healthier and more sustainable way is as simple as you make it sound, why do we not see that happening even at the industrial crop level?
Well, I mean, you know, there'll be farmers out there listening now, I'm sure, and there are every types of farmer out there. So, you know, this isn't, I'm not trying to criticize farmers, but you know, if you've grown up a certain way of doing things, that seems the way of doing things. In my first book, I covered a system of actual sustainable cattle farming, which Marcus mentioned again, that cattle is a really tough problem. And, you know, you can actually look down the line of a fence between the farm that's using this system and the farm that isn't and see the difference in outcomes. And so Tony, my friend who was taking me around at his place, I said, why does the guy next door not, you know, use this system? You can see down the line of the fence that there's a clear bonus. And he says, oh, well, Mark, these are special Australian fences. They're impervious to ideas. And what he meant by that was, you know, farming is a very traditional business. If you're about to turn around to your dad, who's probably living on the farm, saying, Dad, I think you've been doing it wrong, we go for this new method, that's a very hard thing to do. Also, all the people who sell you the fertilizer and whatever, they're going to be encouraging you and saying, oh, if you stop using this and that, you know, it's going to be bad for you, because they want to protect their profits. So again, it's back to that point you mentioned earlier, Sasha, about the status quo, and everybody who's doing well out of it will always try and keep you, you know, buying their products, thinking their way. And on top of that, there's the kind of the social thing. If you, you know, Tony said this great thing to me. He said, how do you think the person who cut down the last tree on Easter Island felt? And I kind of looked at him and said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, he probably didn't feel anything at all, because he's grown up in a world without trees, pretty much. So that became the new normal. And so the one of the interesting things about the book is these people have kind of stepped out and gone, whoa, hang on, the way we think is normal to do things actually doesn't make any kind of sense when you step back. And that's one of the reasons why in the book so many of the people who made these sort of maverick and brilliant and really hopeful changes, they were outsiders. They came from outside the system. Jamie Hayward, who we talked about earlier, for instance, you know, was a mechanical engineer, no healthcare training at all.
Mark, stand by for a minute, because I want to bring in one of the innovators that you wrote about in your book, also related to food, and that's Ashley Atkinson.
Love Ashley Atkinson.
Well, she's here now, so
she's
you'll get
awesome.
To chat with her. So she is currently in El Paso, Texas, I think visiting friends, but usually lives in Detroit, where she is co-director of Keep Growing Detroit. Ashley Atkinson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
We're glad to have the two of you together. And by the way, Keep Growing Detroit is an organization that promotes urban gardening in Detroit. And Ashley, you made Mark's book. So tell us what your innovation is that landed and became a chapter.
Sure. So in Detroit, we have an abundance of vacant land, and that land can be destabilizing for residents and neighborhoods if it's left unoccupied, unchecked. So what my organization does is help residents turn vacant land and other open spaces across the city into urban gardens and farms. So as of last year, we supported a network of 1,547 sites across the city with about 23,000 Detroiters involved.
And Mark, when you saw that, how much impact did you sense it was having citywide?
Well, the really interesting thing I thought about that was, you know, there are lots of great outcomes from what Ashley's doing, which is that people's health care improves, their health improves, their diet improves. But the really interesting thing is the social cohesiveness. Ashley makes this great point. She says, you know, we don't farm, you know, your lot here, our lot, my lot there. You know, we farm together as communities. And that brings this social cohesion, which Detroit was lacking, of course, because of, you know, what happened with the auto industry and the problems with racism and the whole reason, you know, the whole reasons we can go into about Detroit's decline. Urban farming is not just helping people become healthier, it's also reconnecting the people back to the city in a way that I found quite extraordinary. It's one of the things that comes out of the book a lot, is you find that the change that really works generally comes from the bottom up. It comes from the people. There are some exceptions to that, but the ones, you know, I'd say 80% of the innovations of my book have come from, you know, ordinary folks, usually powered by some kind of democratizing technology or democratizing organizational philosophy like Ashley brings. They're regaining the social contract, saying, no, we don't want the social contract we've been offered. We don't want to be sold food. We want to grow it here, make it for ourselves, for instance. And it's usually catalyzed by people from outside, as I said, the existing system, because they're the ones who go, look, this is wrong. I can see it's wrong. I can see that because I'm an outsider. And one of the really interesting things, people say to me, oh, I don't know anything about healthcare. And I say, well, maybe that maybe make you the best healthcare innovator there is, because you can start to question things that other people take for granted.
So, Mark and Ashley.
So, yeah, I found it just amazing. And I have to say, I had the best salad of my life in Detroit. I still talk about it because the food there is so good.
Was it grown at an urban farm?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. It was at the Astro Cafe, as I recall, and it literally blew my mind.
We have a piece of sound from a Detroit resident who does urban farming. This is Akila Muhammad, and she did an interview with Al Jazeera in which she said there were two reasons why she was drawn to urban farming.
I got into it because I have young children. I wanted to be able to grow food, because I think that growing your own food is one of the most revolutionary acts you can participate in. And I also have a small vegan catering company, so trying to grow for production purposes.
Ashley Atkinson, so there we have not just growing food for health, but also because there's potential economic benefit.
Absolutely. Yeah, so there's about 100 of the growers that we support in a cooperative called Grown in Detroit, and that is our produce brand where we sell the products from our gardens, in some cases very small amounts and in others large, at neighborhood farmers markets and to about 50 local restaurants across the city of Detroit.
Ashley, thank you for that. We're really glad to hear about it. And let's go to another caller. This is Chris calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Chris, welcome to On Point, and tell us where you think there need to be innovations and ones you think may be working, if you have any in mind.
Hey, Sasha. Unfortunately, I'm mobile and I'm on a cell phone, so my connection is not terribly good and I can't hear you terrifically well. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you very well, yes. Tell us your ideas for what needs innovating.
Well, it's not an original idea, but it's something that I see daily and I'm frustrated by that there's not implementation. And your speaker, I'd love to get his input and his thoughts on it. But in the alternative energy industry, there are essentially two primary methods for producing energy by not burning fossil fuels, and that is solar and wind. And both of those are using methodologies that are antiquated, that are rather old, and they are rather foolish. And there are proven and known improvements, but they're not being adopted. And I'd like your guest's input as to his understanding as to why that may be so. I take his comments offline.
Great, Chris, thanks for that. And Mark Stevenson, is the answer, as you said before, status quo, or is it more than that?
I mean, it's really interesting that point that Chris made, that even in an industry like renewables, which is, you know, seen as kind of out there and, you know, changing the world, that you get within it stagnation. Because, you know, once somebody's built a business model, say, in making a particular type of solar panel, they don't really want to innovate and make another one that may be cheaper to produce or might be produced locally. The one thing I would say, I don't know what Chris does for a living, but, you know, I'm very lucky and I spend my life sort of running around the world looking at innovation. I'm not seeing a shortage of innovation in solar or wind or biomass or renewables. The point is that it always takes a while for these innovations to get to the market and scale because of all the problems we've had previously. So, you know, even in these new innovative markets, you get certain people get to a certain point and go, "Oh, I don't want to change anything." Well, I mean, you know, for instance, Apple. You know, I mean, Apple is just, you know, who needs an iPhone X? Who needs an animated emoji to express they're in a panda? You know, it's a useless product. But they're you know, they want to, you know, have their money offshore.
Well, useless so product may be harsh, but certainly there are many useless uses that some people use it for.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, but does anybody need an iPhone X opposed to an iPhone 8 or an iPhone 6 even? I mean, I just can't see what it's for. But, you know, maybe that's a controversial view to an American audience. But you know, Apple doesn't appear to be innovating any meaningful sense for the last 5 or 6 years, as far as I can work out, because they've got built a business model of doing things in a certain way, and that's, you know, that's serving them.
Mark Stevenson, one tech innovation you talk about is an engine that is powered by liquid air. And we have a piece of sound from the British inventor Peter Dearman, who developed a car engine that runs on air. And he spoke with ABC News about the early stages of the engine. Here he is describing it.
So when I look in here, I see a garbage can.
Yeah. That's correct, yeah.
I see
yeah.
a piece of wood, and I see some random string. I mean, this is totally homemade, right?
It is, yes.
What emissions will this car produce?
It won't actually produce any emissions because it's only air that we're using. We're not burning anything.
Mark Stevenson, you wrote about this technology. Tell us more about
it. Yeah. It's just fantastic. I mean, this is a guy who in his shed hacked his lawnmower to run on liquid air. So we've been trying to, run an engine on liquid air. This is not a new idea. You know, if you compress the air and you release it, it can push a piston. The problem has always been that it's just not had the oomph to compete with any other kind of engine. You know, you could do it, but it was kind of a curio. And Peter Dearman worked out that using a trick with antifreeze, a can of antifreeze. He was able to boost the efficiency of the engine massively. And suddenly it became useful, and he hacked his car to run on it, and people started going, but it still doesn't compete like with diesel, but what can it do? And then they had this revelation where they kind of went, because it's running on liquid air, it's running at minus 195 degrees centigrade, which means not only do you get a useful amount of power out of it, you can get refrigeration for free. So now not only do you have an engine that can power things, you've got an engine that can give you a sustainable, non-toxic refrigeration system, which is particularly important for places like the developing economies where there's so much food waste because there's not enough cold chains, as they call them. So this is one that, this is one of these kind of win-win-wins. Again, it's like, oh, it just works for everybody. And the great thing about liquid air, of course, is you can make it anywhere. You don't have to mine or whatever. You can compress the air, and there it is. You've got your fuel source, and you can compress it using renewables. So it's kind of another one of those sort of things that just came out of me, and I was like, this is so cool. He's such an amazing character as well. He invents it in the shed and changes the world.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? And what can a tuna cannery in the middle of the Pacific tell us about taxes? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator, a new podcast from Planet Money, where in every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're talking about innovation and change and what 2018 may bring. You can join the conversation. What innovations do you see a need for in 2018? What do you think is broken and how do you think we should fix it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Mark Stevenson is still with us from London. He's author of the book, We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. And joining us now from Baltimore is Amy Webb. Amy is a professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business. She's also founder of the Future Today Institute that looks at emerging technologies and tracks them as they move into the mainstream. And like Mark, she is a futurist, and she's the author of the book, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Amy Webb, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
And Amy, can you start us off by telling us, why does it take so much effort for new ideas to get a foothold? Mark has talked about the status quo. Is it more than just that?
Sure. Well, just psychologically, humans are averse to change. And, history has shown, and I guess logic would dictate, that as we march towards the future, things evolve. Our attitudes change. Technology evolves. Systems evolve. Evolve along with our technology and our behaviors and our thinking. But confronting that change, especially when it comes to new ideas that challenge the status quo, can be very, very uncomfortable. And for that reason, some of the greatest inventions, some of the most important scientific discoveries have been confronted with fear and anxiety rather than open arms.
So of those ideas that have gotten a foothold and become successful, is there some recipe? Is it a mixture of luck, randomness, money, marketing? Have you seen any pattern?
Sure. And, this is going to sound maybe counterintuitive, but the best recipe really is time. So if you think back to the 1990s, there was a new technology that had actually been in the work for decades, and this is something I describe in the first few chapters of Signals Are Talking. And there were scientific papers published, and it wasn't until a big press conference happened that we all sort of collectively freaked out. And this was cloning, right? So this was a team of researchers who cloned Dolly the sheep. But it didn't happen overnight. Now, what's so fascinating is that all around the world, there were press conferences, there were edicts being handed down from churches. People were really, really terrified of what this new technology meant. And there was talk that we would start cloning people, we would have designer babies, there were tons of magazine covers. And years later, what ultimately happened, we wound up with new drugs that were quite beneficial, not demons, right?
Although I think there still is some discomfort, certainly, over that idea.
Well, there is some discomfort, but for the most part, in the United States, unless you are locally sourcing and growing your entire supply chain of food and all of the products that you use, and in that I would include your own soil, you know, 80% of what you touch, what you come into contact with, has in some way been modified. But again, think about that word modified, that signals change, and it's the opposite of the status quo, right? There are certainly plenty of cases where change is not good, but, Mark was describing a lot about sort of great innovations in food agriculture, and, you know, we are now standing on the precipice of another game-changing technology. This is CRISPR-Cas9, which is a gene editing technique, which could mean that in places like Detroit or places like Baltimore, we could start to solve for food deserts by having, you know, tiny little urban farms that take very little space and are, you know, resistant to our new extreme weather and climate that could feed neighborhoods. And we have, because of AI and automation, you know, sweeping changes afoot that would potentially or could potentially turn every Walmart location or every, you know, pick a big box retailer where you live into a neighborhood greenhouse. So, again, it requires a different mindset.
Amy, thanks for that. Mark Stevenson, could you weigh in on whether you feel like you've seen a pattern for what makes certain ideas take root while others never really grow?
Yeah, I mean, I would reiterate Amy's point. In my first book, I interviewed a guy called George Church, who runs Harvard Medical School's genetics lab, and he says people start, you know, adopting technology when they stop sucking. So what he meant, he gave the example of IVF. He said, you know, if you go back to 1968, when the first sort of test tube baby, as it was kind of, you know, emotionally called, was sort of announced, everybody was up in arms. 97% of people, public opinion, was against it. This is man playing God. It's the most intimate part of the human relationship. There's no way we should be doing anything like this. And then when it started to work regularly and people started to find, you know, neighbors of theirs who were previously infertile having cute kids, there was almost a 180-degree flip in public opinion where people said, actually, you know, I demand this on my health insurance. I, you know, writing to their MP or their senator going, you know, why can't we get hold of this more easily? So it is about that point about, is it useful to society? And then when Amy's point about, you know, actually if you start to use cloning to create drugs, which means grandmother is no longer dying of cancer, people start to go, well, maybe that's a good thing. But this is always the battle with technology. It's a cultural battle as much as a technological one, because every technology can be used for good or for evil. And this is where the legislators and the cultural conversation has to come in. It's where you know, conversations like this one we're having now are really important. So, and that's why I do my work. My work's about making people future literate, saying, look, here's what's happening with genetics. Here's what's happening with energy. This is a conversation we need to have, because the more people have it and the more diverse the voices are in that conversation, the better chance, I think, we have of having better outcomes rather than the horrible ones that the press always often leads on.
Mark, let's hear from a caller from Oklahoma. This is Lynn calling from Ponca City. And Lynn, welcome to On Point. Tell us where you think innovation is needed.
Yes. Hi, Sasha. I'm wondering if your speaker there has anything to say about overpopulation. Obviously, the future of the planet will depend on being able to sustain this huge and growing population. Is there something in the works or somebody who has an idea about promoting the idea of smaller families? I'll just go off the air and listen to you there. Thank you.
Lynn, thanks for that. Mark, thoughts on that one?
So population comes up a lot in my work. So it's the big scare story because the population is growing, and it's growing by billions. There is good news. The good news is that the population, the growth rate of the population is dropping. So it used to be back sort of 1960s that if you took the world as a whole, on average, every woman had 5 children. Now that's down to about 2.3, and replacement rate is about 2.1, which will hit sometime towards the end of this century. And that'll leave us with, according to the UN, they have this thing called the median variant estimate, which is sort of statistician speak for best guess. And they reckon we're somewhere between 10 and 11 billion people. Why is the birth rate dropping? Lots of debate about this. One defensible argument is that as countries urbanize, that has a positive effect on female emancipation, access to healthcare, etc. And that reduces the birth rate. And most of the population growth will be handled by cities. So that might be one good argument. Now, can we support 11 billion people? Well, yes, we can, but not, to Lynn's worry, not if we carry on doing the things we're doing at the moment. If we carry on with the unsustainable food system we have, no way we can feed 11 billion people. But if we move over to things like agroecology and we use sensible applications of genetic modification or cloning or whatever, if we have this debate sensibly, then yes, we can easily sustain that many people and sustain them all very, very, very handsomely. So again, this is why I do the work I do. I'm sure it's the reason Amy does her work as well. It's like, let's have a literate conversation about all the technologies and options and ways of organizing ourselves out there. And then we can start to make proper decisions rather than sort of knee-jerk decisions about stuff because, the Washington Post or the New York Times is scared us to death with, one particular viewpoint.
Many of our listeners, On Point listeners, have gone onto our website and onto Twitter to throw out ideas, and they're focused on big picture things like how to fix education, how to fix criminal justice. Oh. And certainly politics comes up a lot because so many people think politics is broken. Mark, you have a chapter about a city in Brazil where people have gotten more engaged through something called participatory budgeting. I'm interested in this because here in Massachusetts, that's done in Cambridge, Massachusetts. A few times a year, something like a pot of about $500,000, the people get to decide how to spend it. Should it go to bike racks, water fountains? Tell us about how that worked in Brazil and how it energized people.
Well, it's really interesting. So this came out of the back of the end of the dictatorship in Brazil. And so Brazilian cities started saying, well, one particular city called Porto Alegre said, we really think the people should be more involved in this. It was the most counterpoint to a dictatorial regime. They said, we want neighborhoods to decide how to spend their own taxes. And they created this system called participatory budgeting. And it turns out that it works really, really well, because it turns out that the people actually living in the city, particularly if you engage the poorest and the most marginalized, they tend to make the best decisions about where the taxes are spent, because they're living with the consequences of them being spent badly previously. If you do it for a year or two, makes no difference. People don't get all that engaged. It takes a while to change the culture of the city. And again, I keep referring to this point about culture, how you change the way people think about stuff. But if you do this for 10 or 15 years, as places like Belo Horizonte or Porto Alegre have done in Brazil, the outcomes for the city are extraordinary on every measurable way you can think, whether it comes to healthcare, infant mortality, access to education, culture, the economy, tax receipts. People become more engaged with the government. They trust the government more, but people have returned trust to these institutions that are governing them, because now they're involved. Corruption goes down. The cost of public projects goes down because everybody's now more interested in keeping them that way and better managed. And it also provides a political dividend for any politician who wants to actually give their power away. It turns out they get a 10-point hike in the elections next time around. So this idea of involving people in how to spend their own taxes is a really good idea. Now, most people wouldn't want to do that, right? Most people are busy. Most of your listeners are going, well, I haven't got time to go and go to meetings about that.
I think we've lost Mark. We're going to try to get him back. But we do have a caller I want to bring in. And this is Nate calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Nate, welcome to On Point, and let us know what you think about innovations and what needs to be fixed.
Hi, Sasha. Yes, I'm a UConn grad, and one thing that I keep seeing over and over in a lot of the different studies I've gone through is the concept of power and human nature. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this. People have innovated new engines, new ways of doing things, incredible innovations that are much more sustainable than the current ways of doing things. And the problem that keeps resurfacing time and time again is when an individual or a group of individuals or a good idea becomes more common, they begin to kind of sell out. Alternative engines that run off of, or engines that run off of alternative sources of energy, those have been created for a long time. They've been around for a long time.
And where does the selling out happen? What's an example, Nate, of someone who's sold out?
Contracts that get sold to large car manufacturers that run off of different sources of energy. Anybody that has, I think, gone through, tried to come up with a better way of doing something, but have stayed with securing their own economic interest or personal interest.
Nate, thanks for that. Amy Webb, let me put that to you. Do you agree with the caller? Do we see people who, once they get a taste of money or success or a chance to have their product go mainstream, they are willing to water down their ideas and accept less?
Well, you know, I think it's important not to generalize. There are plenty of examples of great innovations that pivot, or move into a different direction, especially when folks are trying to scale their ideas. You know, it's a lot different coming up with a solution, you know, thinking about the future and mapping out the future for your local community or even your organization, right, than trying to scale that to the size of a nation state. That becomes very, very complicated, whether you are working in policy, you know, or you've got some cool new water filter.
And it requires some compromise sometimes that may look like a sellout?
That's right. I mean, you know, again, it costs money to produce good work, regardless of the space that you're working in. You know, and that's, a constant challenge. However, you know, the worst thing that anybody can do, whether they're in business or government or just an individual, is to make a decision under duress. So one of the things that I'm constantly explaining to folks is that there is no such thing as future-proofing, because we hear that a lot. And since we cannot know exactly what the future looks like, we have to be more flexible in our thinking. And to some, you know, sometimes to outsiders, that may look like selling out, or that may look like making decisions for monetary gain. But, you know, sometimes if you dig deeper, it's less nefarious than that, right? It's more about the survival of that idea.
Mark Stevenson, we got you back. We lost you briefly. I think we have you back on the line. We have a listener who on Twitter poses a question to you, and I think it might be a nice way to close out the hour. She writes, Listening to you now on NPR and am wondering how you implement this into your personal life. How can I make myself better, stronger, smarter without sitting in the status quo? So any advice for people at the individual level?
I run this thing in London called the League of Pragmatic Optimists, and we have 8 principles for how to govern your life, your career, your business in a way that can help you be kind of able to handle a difficult and uncertain future. And we have 8 simple principles, and I don't have time to go through them all now, but one of them is always believe that a better future is possible, because you can't make it until you can imagine it. I mean, when people ask me who my favorite futurist is, I always say Martin Luther King, because not only was he brilliant at telling you what was wrong, but he was also brilliant at telling you how it could be and how much better that could be. So always imagine as better as possible, because without that, you can't start the day. Try not to be cynical. This is one of the problems we have with people with new ideas. People come to you with a new idea, you don't want to change, so you dress up your kind of poo-pooing of it as wisdom, call that cynicism. But cynicism doesn't really help you create a new world. Engineer serendipity. Smash yourself into as many new ideas as possible. Steve Jobs said creative people feel guilty because they didn't really do it. And what he means is they smashed into so many different ideas that eventually that new sparkly idea became obvious to them and they were able to create something new. And the other thing is just don't give up. I always tell all the people I'm working with that when it's getting really hard and you feel like giving up, guess what? All your competitors are. So just keep going.
Mark Stevenson, thank you for that. He's author of the book We Do Things Differently, The Outsiders Rebooting Our World. And Amy Webb has also been with us. She's a professor at the NYU Stern School of Business, founder of the Future Today Institute, and the author of The Signals Are Talking. Amy and Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And listeners, continue the conversation on Twitter or on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, author Ann Patchett joins us to talk about her year of no shopping. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.